some of the previous speakers, so I'm going to assume that you can see me as well. I'm going to pace back and forth a little bit like Mark. Sometimes people accuse us of sharing a brain, so I'm going to mimic his presentation style as well. No offense to Mark. I want to take the opportunity to really extend my thanks to the host and organizing committee, headed very ably by Herb McLean. And if you get the opportunity, if you haven't done so already, please stop by, catch one of these folks in the white shirts with the logo on it, including Doris and Don McKenzie and Herb, and give them thanks for the really nice job that they've done in hosting BIF this year. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate the invitation, although I have to point out in Don McKenzie's favor here that a couple of months ago, maybe six or eight, I get a call in the office saying that they wanted my input on both BIF Awards Committee and on a little bit of program planning and helping identify and locate speakers and identify topics. I naively agreed to do that. And I am standing here before you as evidence that the punishment for being recruited is as they stick you on the program. So with that, I also want to, before we get started, make due diligence to my collaborators, both Stephen Moore from the University of Alberta, who many of you know, and Mark Enns for their invaluable input on this presentation. I rely on people like Steve and Mark and others in the academic community who are hell of a lot smarter than I am to pull me back from the edge sometimes and remind me when I'm about to make an idiotic remark. So, as the title slide indicated, talking about traditional versus marker-assisted selection. We've had a lot of comments and people have made a lot of motions and have been waving their hand for a lot of decades now about transitioning from existing models for genetic evaluation on a national level towards a system where DNA, marker tests, high-density SNP chips, whole genome selection will become more of a predominant force in the North American effort to improve beef cattle. So my objectives today are to put that in context with what I have seen evolving in the scientific and the application areas of national cattle evaluation, starting with the traditional and moving to what I consider to be the optimal way that we might start to incorporate these things into our evaluation programs in a useful and somewhat optimal way. Now, and I start this by saying that, you know, John Pollock at the beginning of these meetings gave us a challenge of here's where we are today, here's where we need to be in the future, how are we going to get there? So hopefully when we're done, you will consider this to be a little bit of a get or done kind of a slideshow. So in traditional terms, national cattle evaluation has evolved today to the point where it's conducted nationally and in many cases internationally, which Dr. Anderson pointed out, on a breed-specific basis. There is an interest in multi-breed genetic evaluation from several points of view, and that has progressed. And it really has emphasized, in my mind, a couple of points about genetic evaluation and making sustainable genetic progress. We have to remember that EPDs are generally not comparable across breeds, mostly a within breed effort, although there have been some efforts to combine those and make a crossbreed comparisons. For any one breed, these national cattle evaluation systems contain both what I refer to as common traits. Some of you are familiar with birth, weaning, yearling weight, scrotal. Mark made a nice list of those that he referred to as lower hanging fruit. And there is an emerging and somewhat disparate set of novel traits that are not universal across the industry. I refer to them as novel. But they are new ways that breeds have identified to increase the profitability or competitiveness or the sustainability of their breed and to their customers. In in genetic evaluation. Now, one thing that we cannot forget is that over the past 30 years, the leaders at this very meeting that have spoken to you time in and time out, including Dick Wilhelm, Larry Cundiff sitting right over here, Dale Van Vleck, going all the way back to the fathers and founders of animal breeding as we know it today, have really done a nice job of reinforcing the fact that NCE systems work. We know how to do it. It's mature. And I would put to you that traditional national cattle evaluation programs based on solid pedigree data, good phenotyping, is mature, and we know how to do it. Mark alluded to the fact that if you ever wanted proof of that, just go and pick your favorite breed, go to their website, and look at their genetic trend over the last 25 years. For every output trait EPD that's ever been published, there is a non-zero positive genetic trend. Producers use it, they understand it, and those producers in the seed stock and commercial industry that are of consequence believe in that system. New traits for national cattle evaluation, I'll make this point quickly, must follow the framework of economic relevance. Mark did an excellent job just previously of giving you the rules for making the distinction between true ERTs and their indicators and how they fit into a comprehensive national cattle evaluation program. And that is sort of still the guiding principle that I have used when I put together my thoughts on incorporation of genomic data into these national or population-wide programs. The thing that we are faced with in this transitional period that Dr. Pollack has outlined and challenged us with is that EPDs are the sum of very small, sustainable, additive genetic effects, and in some respects are considered a bit of a genetic black box, that we really don't know the underlying QTL or causative mutation that leads to these observed differences of genetic nature. So, as we start looking at a framework and a system, we can identify some properties that we like to see that lead to successful evaluation programs. First of all, under the ERT concept and framework that Mark did, we have to make the distinction that one desirable property of a trait is a direct effect on revenue or cost. You'll notice there's a list, and that is only one item on the list, so we do allow for the fact that there are more than one or more than small groups of ERTs in any production system, and there is an entire suite of indicators for those ERTs, and we want to keep that in mind. Easily and cheaply measured is always a consideration when cost-benefit ratios are evaluated in terms of how much do we have to invest for the value of the information that's going to come back to us. Stable genetic parameters is something for Mark and I to worry about. I can tell you from an NCE backgrounding and development point of view on the research side that we love this one, but you as producers don't generally need to be involved with that component. High data density. Data density leads to accuracy. And following from Pollack's comment about using all the information about available in the most accurate way to make the best selection decision at that time relates to high data density leading to high accuracy. Few genetic antagonisms. Mark touched on this as well. We need to design systems that are comprehensive of the entire production chain. We don't want a single trait select, and we don't want to select traits that have negative impact on our cooperators in other segments of the industry. We like EPDs that are measured early in life. We're making a lot of our genetic progress and a lot of our selection decisions on bulls that are about 12 months of age. So we'd like to really focus on increasing the accuracy of evaluating those young sires. EPDs are user-friendly. This has a lot of concept to it. EPDs need to be user-friendly in terms of interpreting the optimal way to implement them in your program. And it also needs to not add to this big, onerous thing that we've heard a lot about of information overload. We'll talk more about that. High genetic variants and several indicators. That's another thing that I'll just skim over quickly because Mark's already told you. The key to genetic progress depends on genetic variants, accuracy, and intensity. And that's what those things really are involved. Let me give you some good examples from experience. Direct effect on carcass, or direct effect on revenue or cost. Carcass yield and feed intake are good examples. Those are things that you pay for or get paid for. Easily and cheaply measured, weight. It's no secret why birth, weaning, and yearling weights were the first EPDs that breed associations published. They were part of the normal working protocols on most ranches. Stable genetic parameters, growth rate. I'm an associate editor for the Journal of Animal Science in the Animal Genetics Division and see most of the quantitative genetic papers that are submitted for publication in that journal. I can tell you that if you submit a paper that estimates the heritability of weaning weight through my division, you have about a 10% chance of getting that paper published. We know it. It's stable. Let's move on. Growth rate also fits on the high data density, basically because it's easy and cheap to measure. Measured few genetic antagonisms. There are very few examples of that because as an integrated biological system, we rarely, if ever, find a case where we can change one phenotypic characteristic without having impact on others. Measured early in life, basically anything measured up to yearling fits as a good example. EPDs are user-friendly. We've always seen positive genetic trend for growth traits. Its output, more, means higher income. High genetic variant, I'm going to argue that growth rate still has a lot of genetic variants out there. And that we have a lot of traits at our disposal, if we can find a way to measure them, that offer us a lot of opportunities because the genetic variants exist to make those permanent and sustainable changes. Several indicators, carcass merit. We've already heard the example of real-time ultrasound being used in yearlings to predict carcass merit EPDs that relate to carcass grid superiority in their progeny. Fertility, Mark has already told you about the scrotal circumference example. And these are the concepts that I mean here. Poor examples. Direct effect on revenue or cost. Birth weight. Higher birth weight doesn't make you any more money than low birth weight does. I know what you're thinking. High birth weight means I'm going to pull more calves. Yes, but not perfectly so. I'm not saying birth weight's not an important trait to measure. It's an indicator. Scrotal is another one because we've already said the main reason that we evaluate scrotal is it's a highly heritable, cheap, easy-to-measure phenotype on yearling bulls. We care nothing about the size of a bull's testicles beyond what it can tell us about his and his daughter's fertility. I don't know anybody who makes a living in the beef industry selling testicles. Easily and cheaply measured. Poor examples. These are the higher hanging fruits, people. Feed intake, carcass merit, longevity, stayability, maternal productivity. Stable genetic parameters. Mark, wouldn't you love a fertility evaluation with a heritability of 0.25 and not have to worry about or deal with threshold models? High data density. And you'll notice that a lot of these kind of go in pairs. High data density is always inversely proportional to how easy it is and cheaply it is to collect that data. So feed intake and carcass merit also go in that Genetic antagonisms, if there are very few that are good examples, that means most of them must be pretty poor examples. So we've got to be on our toes and build these things in a multiple trait context such that we don't make a lot of errors. And the rest of them, I think, are pretty self-explanatory using the comments that I've already talked about before. So, that sort of sets the stage in a traditional sense. How do we proceed in the Pollock-esque challenge of getting from here to there in the era of omics? Everything nowadays, from an academic and research perspective, I can promise you, in order to increase their validity or their soundbite potential or their ability to capture big grant money, everybody wants to put omics at the end of what they do. I'm going to do it myself, so I'm not being condescending. So how are we going to approach genetic evaluation in the omics era? There's a tremendous interest, and rightly so, in identifying major genes, which unravel or demystify that genetic black box, which is breeding value or EPDs. Conceptually, these models and these approaches are still developing. But what we're looking at is partitioning that black box into a lot of little things that we don't worry about identifying causative function and stuff that is identifiable. And they have been in the past term major genes. And the information package that comes out of this needs to rely, I will put to you, on the framework that we have established in the industry over the last 20 years or longer, that we need a piece of information to make a selection decision that is, as Pollock said, the most accurate that we can get at the time based on the information that we've got, and move ahead. Marker-assisted evaluation is a term that I collectively use to refer to all of this adaption, inclusion, commingling of phenotypic and molecular data and tools from both the genomic and the phenotypic side in benefiting population-wide, industry-wide genetic improvement. What you've heard a lot about so far this week is we want to focus on those young sires. We want to focus on those traits where phenotypic data streams are really, really limited and probably always will be. And as Mark sort of alluded, under this heading of phenomics, that's my omics label, we are looking at optimally combining marker and phenotypic data under the challenge of making the best decision we can based on the information that we've got. We recognize the continued necessity and importance of phenotypic data, but we use the marker data to help us where it can. Methods to better allow for utilization of improving and developing technology up to and including high-density SNP chips. And I'm going to show you some of my thoughts on how this is very desirable in a system that's very likely to occur in a very short period of time where animals may have either phenotypic data or marker data, but likely not both. Traditional NCE, now I'm going to tell you, this is Twig's slide. I put this up for Twig Marston. Twig, as you all know, and from his comments yesterday, he really loves these matrix representations. And Twig, I've got you some inverses in there and a whole bunch of mathematical speak that I know is generally taboo, but we've heard three PhD-level trained geneticists already this morning. Not one of them put up a mathematical slide. Shame on you. But for those of you who like such things, traditional NCE that we know how to do that's represented in those top equations still provides us a framework for adding that lower portion where we basically just start to partition out those marker effects and sort of demystify that EPD black box. So, back to my points about data density, heritability, and accuracy. How do those things interact? Well, here's a simple graph that everyone who's ever taken a course in animal genetics has seen. On the x-axis, I'm going to say we've just going to generically label that information. I don't care where that information comes from. It's just information. On the y-axis, those of you who are familiar with EPDs will recognize that I'm just doing polygenic EPD accuracy from its theoretical minimum of 0 to its maximum of 1. And on the right there, I have said as we increase heritability, we basically change the shape of that curve in which we accumulate accuracy. There's a couple of take-home points from this graph. First of all, if you wanted to remove that x-axis and put information from markers, or if you wanted to remove that and put some other relative measure of information density, this graph would look exactly the same. Another point to take home is that, like some of our colleagues at these very meetings have said, I'm not scared of a trait that has very small proportions of genetic control. But I have to be aware that if I want to evaluate them accurately, I need more information to make that accurate selection decision. Because we go, in this example, from a heritability of 10% all the way to a heritability of 0.6, which is sort of the functional range of most of the traits that we deal with. They all increase accuracy of evaluation with more information. So let's say that under this model of making an accurate decision based on as much information as I can gather, we decide to make these phenomic cost and value decisions about moving towards a framework of marker-assisted EPDs or marker-assisted evaluation. What do we need to think about? Well, where is this investment best justified, especially in these early days? My suggestion is, first and foremost, as we've heard time and time again, through example and through wisdom, where phenotypic data collection is time-consuming, it's expensive, it's laborious, or collection systems are likely to never exist, are prime candidates where we will see early benefits very quickly. Few or no indicator traits can be or have been identified. There are new approaches to measurement of traits like fertility, like efficiency, where the methodology is such that we force ourselves not to have any indicators. Because of avoiding antagonisms, we sort of force everything to be independent, which drags with it the trade-off that we've forced ourselves not to have any indicators. We need to identify in these circumstances marker sets, genomic information, if you will, that are explaining at least moderate amounts of the variance in the trait that we're trying to improve. And we have to keep in mind the cost of genotype. Some candidates have been identified. Feed intake and efficiency is an obvious example of where marker-assisted evaluation could lead to better short-term gains than relying entirely on traditional methods of evaluation. Fertility is another one. There's a lot of work going on in that area. Disease resistance. I really hope that you folks took the opportunity to speak with Mark Enns or listen to his outline yesterday afternoon about a big fertility and genetics of disease tolerance, disease resistance yesterday afternoon. Palatability and meat composition is also being implicated in this area, simply because we've never been able to do a very good job of collecting tenderness and helpfulness data on a large scale. Let's take feed intake as an example. clearly a call-side ERT, where greater than 65% of non-fixed beef production costs are related to what that steer eats in the feedlot, what that heifer eats while she's developing to be a replacement, and what that cow is supplemented during the winter on the range. Intake and efficiency, however, have complex interrelations with other ERTs. This is the genetic antagonisms thing, where growth, mature size, body composition, they're all interrelated. And we have to remember that we have to consider these things in the context of multiple trait selection. Traditional evaluation as a result of feed intake and efficiency has progressed relatively slowly. And some key reasons for that is that point per animal data collection costs approach $150 a head. Very low data density, especially at the population level or breed level. Expression of intake and efficiency in the current thinking, whether it be by an index approach or by RFI, forces us to have very few indicators. Polygenic architecture, however, is very well known in terms of parameters and conducting an NCE, but we just still have prototypical programs for a very few breeds because data collection is so limited. How does feed intake stack up? I'm not telling you anything new when I point out that obviously feed purchases have a direct direct effect on production bottom line. It's not easy to measure. We know how to do it, so the genetic parameters. It's expensive and difficult, so we don't have a lot of data density. We can manage the antagonism question. We can relatively measure it early in life. Most bulls are tested near yearling age on performance tests. Progeny can be tested in the feedlot before they reach 16 months of age. EPDs are user-friendly and so forth. And just some comments that I would make. Remember that infrastructure is really our bottleneck and our limiting factor in a trait like intake. And these are the kind of logistical issues that we're going to have to deal with if we're going to make a real effort in this area, whether it be bimolecular or traditional mechanisms. But we've got a lot of genetic variants out there in efficiency and intake that we can exploit to our benefit. Most studies would indicate at least 6 pounds of dry matter intake per day is genetic. Sitting there waiting for us to find a way to tap that potential to decrease the intake requirements of our national cow herd. So let's shift gears and say, how have we done? Where are we headed? What progress have we and will we make on the genomic side of tackling a trait like intake and by extension efficiency? Well, many of you probably will be familiar with the leptin example. I'm using this as an example. It is somewhat engineered and not to be taken as a take-home message, but an illustration. I've got a hypothetical leptin gene here, thanks to Steve Moore for supplying the graphics, which I have modified, and if there are any errors, Steve, you're free to blame them all on me. But I think for the purposes of our illustration, we see leptin as a gene has three major exonic regions. These are the regions which actually code for something, like a protein or an amino acid or an enzyme. The green arrow indicates the promoter region, which in leptin, as a hormone-producing gene, sort of acts a bit like a volume knob. You still use that analogy, Steve? It's a relatively big gene. That's almost 20,000 base pairs there. Why is it a candidate? Why do we think there's valuable information in leptin? It's been well characterized in other species. Man, we really take advantage of the fact that the mammalian genome is highly conserved. So we can learn about leptin in cattle by reading what we know about leptin in rats. function of the leptin hormone is well known. It's been well characterized in these model species. It has appetite regulatory functions. It has energy partitioning functions. And this promoter region has even been implicated in up or down regulating directly plasma leptin concentrations. And one of the nice things from the functional genomic or structural genomic point of view is that this gene is particularly SNP rich, marker rich. We can find lots of things. So let's pull out that promoter region. There's probably been what, Steve? 20 promoter region SNPs that have been found. I'm going to focus on one that was developed and identified in my good friend Steve Moore's lab in Edmonton, right up the road here, UASMS2. It's a C to T mutation that exists. Now, in our research populations in Lethbridge, we have purebred Angus and Charolais that were all genotyped. We went in and had Steve genotype all of our cattle. There's the gene frequencies. They're in equilibrium. We find a fairly low minor allele frequency, but that's no problem because all the genotypes seem to be represented in the data set. So then, what do you do when you say, okay, we know this these cattle have certain variants of this SNP. Is that associated with differences in phenotypes? So we do a little genotype association study, and we find this. In the first section of this graph is the least square means or the averages for animals by their genotype for both dry matter intake and RFI, two alternative ways of expressing intake and efficiency. What do you notice? This allele has absolutely no effect in Angus, but a fairly substantial effect in our Charolais. Take home, we got to be sure that these SNPs are robust. We got to be sure that we develop panels that incorporate information, and we need to be aware that Indicus taurus, continental versus British, may be important distinctions to make as we move forward with developing these marker information systems. So let's build a breeding value. Let's build a molecular breeding value based on this rather isolated single SNP. That's all the math that we can do. It's really very straightforward. The important point that we're looking for is how much genetic variance at the end of the day can we explain in our ERT of interest with this marker set. I say set in kind of a glib way because it's only one marker. This is a hypothetical example for illustration purposes, so I don't want you to go home thinking that this is the only one available to us. This is one single gene example. But when we do these evaluations, we find that only 5% of the genetic variance in intake is attributable to this single marker, as we expected. Not enough alone. Multiple markers, they're commercially available, and we can move forward with these from small sets up to the 50K chip that you've been hearing about, and even 300,000 SNPs. What we have to remember here is how much information will we be able to derive. My approach has been to take genomic breeding value and consider that as a combination from that very conceptual approach of separating EPD or breeding value from what the markers can tell us. It's really a very straightforward mathematical approach, remembering that how much improvement we can make by using marker information depends on two things and two things only. How accurate can we evaluate that trait using traditional methods, and how much genetic variance can we explain by adding markers to the mix? I want to show you just a few graphs about how we see this in practice when we can get genotyping costs down below $100 and make it informative and useful for the average producer, and we make sure that we do our homework on validation and continued recalibration of these panels, however dense they become or however sparse they remain. Information packaging is important, and we have to keep this in mind. And I'll give you an example. Those of you in the industry are very familiar with this. It's a very shallow pedigree that you might see in an AI stud catalog that will often be accompanied by EPDs. That first line is the EPD. Second line is accuracy. Third line is the rank within the breed. If you take a quick glance at this bull, you characterize him low calving ease, high birth weight, quick growth, not much scrotal, breed average for lean yield, and pretty near the bottom of the breed for marbling. The thing we have to guard against is publishing a marker score separately that says on some hypothetical commercial test, he's plus five or whatever their highest score is, which creates the disparity. Which one is right? So, the point I want to make is illustrated, I think, with the reverse of that situation. Here's another bull that's kind of the opposite. High calving ease. Moderate growth. Lots of fertility. Reasonably positive for lean yield, but near the top of the breed for marbling score. Quantitative information tells us that we're pretty confident in those decisions by the fact that all those EPDs are 70 or more percent accurate. So along comes our marbling test. We publish it separately that he doesn't have any of the right alleles. What happens to this bull? Unfortunately, that's what happens. Here's a few graphs, and I'll just close with these. If we have a panel that D value in red is 10%, that is, we can attribute 10% of the genetic variance in our trait of interest to our marker set, whether it's based on two SNPs or 300,000. If we don't have an EPD, if we don't have any phenotypic data, no pedigree ties, no other information, we can take that and produce a genomic breeding value that's about 25 to 30% accurate. But as we have access and availability to traditional phenotypic information going up on the x-axis, the impact of that 10% marker set is decreasing. So let's make our marker set better. Let's account for 20% of the variance. We can start out and we can get to a more accurate total evaluation. And the good point here is that with no EPD, no other source, if we've got a panel that's this good, we can get information on selection decisions that we didn't have through other methods. And the extreme case, D is 40%, we see the same pattern. So my final thoughts: marker-assisted evaluation in beef cattle, potential is huge. And we are gaining a critical mass of momentum. As Stuart Bach, my good friend at Mariel, says, we have almost reached the tip of that summit where we're going to gain a lot of momentum. Evaluation using markers, I still think, will impact some traits more than others. And we have to keep in mind cost versus benefit decisions as we move through that transition from today to pollux tomorrow. So with that, I thank you for your attention, and I'll take any questions. But before I do, I will give light to the rumors that, yes, I will be giving this as my last talk with Ag Canada. Next time you see me, I'll be wearing the Ram badge of Colorado State University. So, Herb, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan.